True Crime Society podcast contains adult themes and violence and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. And if you'd like to skip the intro or move to any specific part of the podcast, please refer to the timestamps listed in the episode description. Thank you. What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the True Crime Society podcast with Stephanie and Olivia. It is August 30th, 2026. I did remember to hit record. I've checked it about 47 times because I will forever be traumatized by not hitting record. But thank you to everyone who sent me nice messages saying like, hey, shit happens, and it still sounded okay.
I feel like it's gone from a turn because for a few weeks everyone was really mean. Not everyone. Obviously, we always get nice messages, but there was a lot of mean comments from people, whereas this week has been, everyone's been much more chill.
Yeah, it just takes me crying. So, but yeah, so we're recording. I'm back up recording. I learned my lesson. So hopefully we're good for another 6 years or whatever.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. I did want to say I was editing the Micah episode, and Olivia did watch the documentary. I haven't watched it yet, so she'll talk about her thoughts on that in a minute. But editing that episode, I post this to my Instagram story. It was shocking to me hearing how much more energy and like how much more life I had in me in 2024. So I posted on my story saying like, I really hope to get back to that level soon. I really do. And I think I will. I'm just, you know, going through some tired times these days. But hearing that, I was just like, damn, I miss having that energy and being able to be like loud in my apartment and had time to like do all this like crazy research and for hours. So, you know, I'll get back there again. So I just wanted to thank everyone for sticking with me during the tough times.
Yeah, it's just a season. Like I said in the Patreon, it's just a season. You'll be back.
Yeah. I miss having a brain. I miss feeling like I can form like a solid thought. I was listening to myself in an episode. I was like, oh, I sound so intelligent. we're going to get through it. We got 1 year down.
Yeah.
Only way is up. Knock on wood.
It is interesting. Like when you, I feel like sometimes you also don't realize when you get out of that season, you look back and you think, oh, actually, like I know you're still newly in it, but for me now, I've been a parent for a while. I'm like, oh, well, that last few months have actually been all right. And then you just don't realize it's such a slow progression out of it that sometimes it's hard to realize when you are out of it.
Yeah. Right now, it's just a lot of ups and downs. Like 2 weeks ago, it was like great. He was sleeping great. And now I'm just back in like regression hell. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that I'm almost out of this regression because it's been over a week and I'm sick of it. So hopefully by the time this episode comes out, hopefully by the time the Patreon episode comes out, things will be looking up because anyways, we'll do our Patreon subscribers and listener of the week, and then Olivia will talk a little bit about the Micah documentary. So the Patreons who subscribed this week, we have Sarah, Lee, Steph, Aaron, Allie, Jen, Ann, Emily, Tess, Nicole, Rocky, Nikki, Everybody Touched the Toys, Laura, Morgan.
I love it when we get just a random name.
Yeah. And the last one was Morgan. I don't know if it was heard over us laughing over Everybody Touched the Toys. And then do you want to do the Listener of the Week?
Yeah, so Listener of the Week, this one is Spudna1. They wrote, I love you guys and the way you talk through about these often mega frustrating cases. You're one of the only podcasts where I still listen to your episodes, even if I've heard of the case before and others. P.S. Also love the life updates, especially as a fellow new mom. Thanks for all the hard work.
I see you, fellow new mom.
So I did watch the Micah Miller documentary yesterday. I just had no energy. I thought I'm just going to rot on the couch and watch it. So I did. I watched all three. It's like a three-part thing. I thought it was really well done. I didn't think there was anything particularly groundbreaking. But for us, it has been now over 2 years since we covered the case. So I really think it was a very well done overview of the case. They do interview Micah's family a lot. So to be fair, it's probably a little bit more, well, it is basically the information from that her side. They do say at the end they asked John Paul and Susie Skinner, his new wife, if they wanted to comment or be in the documentary, and they refused, or I can't remember if they refused or didn't answer, but basically they weren't in it. So one thing I did kind of learn from it is a lot more about Micah's faith. I knew obviously she was married to a pastor, so I knew that she was probably quite involved in that side, but they go through her young life and how they she grew up and always basically belonged to a church, and she that was her place. So they go a lot through her struggles. I just can't believe. Well, I can believe it. We knew it, but and like they even re-showed the video, which we spoke about in an episode, of him lying on the grass and having a meltdown. And when Micah said, "I think she was going to leave him at one point," and
I forgot about that till I edited.
Yeah, just a complete and utter loser. They showed a lot of his sermons in the thing, and the things he spoke about. I don't know. I know when people join a church, they're probably looking for like a sense of belonging and a sense of guidance. But I'm just like, this is so unnecessary. And to be fair, they did highlight a lot of his affairs in the show. But a lot of his sermons were about lust and about how if you don't satisfy your husband will find, you know, get his needs met elsewhere. Like just things like that. He's just a wild, horrible person. They showed a clip from the wedding, Susie and his wedding, which is last year, which we mentioned in our last episode. They do speak about Susie's first husband dying. So, like, I feel like it was a well-done overview of the case. I would absolutely recommend it to anyone. If you aren't super familiar with it and if you haven't watched it yet, I would check it out. We have had a lot of people commenting on the case. I've just picked out a few of them that I found were interesting. One person wrote, "Religious psychosis is real," and that's all they wrote. So I wonder if that was in regards to Micah or if that was in regards to John Paul, because I feel like it could have absolutely been both. I don't know if John Paul actually is, like, I know he's a pastor and a preacher.
He's just like a grifter.
But then I'm like, does he actually believe what he's saying, or is he just making excuses for it? Yeah, I don't think so either. In the documentary, like I still don't think that John Paul killed Micah. I feel like she killed herself. I know in the documentary they do raise it a little bit, like maybe she met him there and he made it look like a suicide, but she called 911. She said, "I want my family to be able to find my body." I feel like she just had enough and he pushed her to that point. Don't get me wrong. I feel like absolutely that's what happened. He basically led to her death. But I feel in terms of, I still don't think he actually killed her. And they say something near the end of the documentary about how she pulled the trigger, but essentially he gave her
the gun.
Do it. Yeah. So another person said, "It sickens me like that people like him get exalted by a community whilst being the most despicable human beings. I went through similar experiences with an ex who played in my worship crew. The stalking harassment led to being hospitalized and diagnosed with similar, multiple times being told that I'm paranoid. I am not. People like him don't stop and the victim feels trapped. It's sad, like she felt the only way to get away from her abuser was by taking her own life. Prayers to her family." Another one says, "I didn't know about this case until the Netflix documentary and I can't let it go. When I see her in the pawn shop buying the gun," so there is footage of her on the day too that she took her life, going to the pawn shop and buying the gun, and they show it in the documentary. She kind of like handles the gun and like, you know, moves it around, I guess, testing to see if it feels, you know, like she could use it. But this person said, "I can't shake the feeling and idea that Micah wants to protect herself. There's so much I don't understand about this case, but I want to see her abuser comes to justice. He needs to be put behind bars for the rest of his life." Then someone else said, "I'm sorry, but I can't believe anyone listened to his so-called sermons. Ooh, he gives me the ick. Sadly, I think she did take her own life, but I think that was a result of his manipulative and demeaning behavior," which I agree with that absolutely. He was just, I don't know, a creep. He's like, I feel like that's the best word to describe him, a total and utter creep. It made me laugh because, which I know it's not a funny story, but they talk about basically his downfall and about how the Solid Rock Church where he preached is basically no more. They were trying to sell the building, and now he and Susie Skinner, who's his new wife, are now preaching in these random little, like they like hire a room where they can go and preach. And
like one a of conference the places, room.
Yeah, basically. And one of the places they were preaching was called The Rat Hole. So I can't remember the lady's name who they interview in the documentary, but she's in it quite a lot and she's a friend of Micah's. But she goes, you know, that's very appropriate, which I thought absolutely it is. They're preaching from dingy little rooms now rather than this church. And to be fair, he did build the church a lot. Like he grew it. they seemed to love him. Like when he was up there preaching his sermons, like everyone's clapping, and he seemed to have a very big following. So his church,
he just seemed like charismatic, like he put on a show.
Yeah, absolutely. And his church was relatively successful, but now basically it seems like they have lost most of it, which, you know, sucks for him, I guess. But I just thought that was interesting that they actually pointed that out, that he's now preaching from a place called the Rat Hole.
That's funny. People like him are like the exact reason why I'm very against mainstream religion in general, because so many people use it as a way to just be grifters, manipulative, and just take advantage of people. And he's just like the perfect example of that.
An absolute predator. Like, maybe I should say allegedly. He's allegedly a predator.
Because he is, though. Like, that's what
he met Micah, I'm pretty sure, first when she was 13. And he's, I have this wrong, but he was like 15, 16 years older than her. So she was 13 and he was in his late 20s. They didn't, I don't think, got together then, but basically, because she was married before, she got married, I think, when she was 18 or 19. And by the time she was kind of in her early to mid 20s, she was with John Paul. So, but he knew her from a teenager. He was, and like they go on about texts that he sent her, like, you know, if you ever need anything, come to me. I'm like, this is just, it's predatory behavior.
Just gross, taking advantage of people. Definitely predatory behavior.
Yeah. So, yeah, I thought it was well done. Very interesting. Very, very, very sad. Like, you just, you know, even they talk about all her medication changes and her weight changes and how she felt self-conscious about that. So she just had a lot going on. It's very, I just feel sad for her that she couldn't, she had filed for divorce basically when she took her own life. So I guess she just really couldn't see any way through. He was so abusive, so relentless in his abuse, you know, tracking her car, putting the razor blades in her tires, all that type of, putting the nude photo of her online. Just, he just wouldn't leave her alone. Yeah, it was horrible.
Yeah. So I definitely want to watch it at some point. I will get around to it if I ever have the time with my baby that doesn't sleep. So I'll let you guys know what I think, but it'll probably be along the same lines.
This is Jess Betancourt, the host of DNA ID, the only true crime podcast that exclusively covers cold cases solved using investigative genetic genealogy, known as IGG. This incredible crime-solving tool has revolutionized criminal investigations and John and Jane Doe identifications and has closed over 1,000 cases. We are now receiving case solve announcements almost daily. DNA ID goes behind the headlines to answer your questions about IGG, how it works, how cases are selected, why the cases were unsolved for so long, and how the justice system is addressing the whole thing. In its over 160 episodes to date, you'll hear about famous cases like April Tinsley, Jennifer Bastian, and Michaela Welch, and fascinating cases you've never heard of, like Patty Stichler and Troy and LaDonna French. DNA ID focuses on the victim with a compassionate, straightforward, and no-nonsense delivery. I predict DNA ID will be your new binge-worthy obsession. And if you're one of the bad guys, they are coming for you.
Okay, so today we're going to be doing an episode on Kids Who Kill. We're going to talk about two cases today. So I'll start with the first one.
Authorities say Matthew Flores went from a missing person to a suspect. This all started with the welfare check last week after family members hadn't heard from Flores or his parents. After finding evidence of human remains in the backyard and a massive cleanup attempt inside their home, Avondale police officers called for federal assistance in this case. They believe the 27-year-old left the U.S. to get away from law enforcement. The U.S. Marshals have obtained a federal arrest warrant and warned that Flores is considered extremely dangerous. Acting U.S. Marshal Van Bayless released a statement saying, in part, every available resource, including domestic and international law enforcement partnerships, will be used to find Flores and bring him back to Arizona to face justice. He adds, crossing international borders will not stop the feds from looking for anyone accused of committing a violent crime. Bayless says his team is committed to the search and securing justice for the victims and their family. He made a similar statement to 12 News last week.
We really are addicted to this hunting of evil people. And so we're going to be relentless. We're going to continue to pursue them. We don't care what country it is or where they are in the world. We are supporting our partner agencies. We are supporting our communities. We will find them and we will bring them back.
A spokesperson for the Flores family also released a statement saying they are absolutely devastated by recent events, clarifying they are fully cooperating with law enforcement and asking for privacy during this difficult time.
A quiet Litchfield Park, Arizona neighborhood became the center of an international manhunt after relatives requested a welfare check on Hector and Larissa Flores and their 27-year-old son, Matthew. Inside the home, police found a significant amount of blood and evidence that someone tried to clean up. Days later, investigators discovered two bodies buried in the backyard. Authorities say Matthew Christopher Flores Semyonov is accused of killing his parents, concealing their remains, and fleeing the United States. Now, with Matthew still at large, investigators are trying to piece together what happened inside that house and why a family disappearance turned into a double homicide investigation spanning international borders. So we'll start some background on the people involved in the case, as always. Hector Flores was born on November 3rd, 1956. Larissa Nikolayevna was born on January 27, 1963. We don't know too much about their personal lives, but according to Larissa's obituary, they had at least three children, a son, a daughter, and Matthew, who was 27. Matthew's name is reported as Matthew Christopher Flores Semyonov, and some reports indicate that he was adopted, but were unable to confirm that, so I don't know if that's where the name comes from. It just seems random.
With Larissa, she does seem to have some type of Eastern European name attached to her. Nikolayevna, I think, is how you say it. Her name is listed everywhere as Larissa Flores. His is Hector Flores. But in his obituary, for example, it says that he was the Atlas of the Flores Semenyov family. So I don't know if that is something to do with her last name. It's just, it's a weird, like, because people have speculated maybe he was adopted and maybe that's why he kind of, you know, something happened within the family. But I am thinking more and more now that maybe it's just to do with Larissa's heritage that there is this name. But we haven't had anything confirmed yet.
So this information is from Larissa's obituary. It says, "She will be missed beyond words and loved beyond measure. Larissa was profoundly kind, funny, humble, intelligent, and resilient, among many, many other amazing qualities. Her greatest legacy is love and friendship she gave so generously, a love that will continue to live on in those who knew her. Her eldest son and daughter humbly dedicate a favorite and most cherished poem to Larissa in her memory, and it's called Wild Geese by Mary Oliver." And there's also a little bit of Hector's obituary. His obituary said, "Hector built his life through courage, sacrifice, determination, and an unwavering devotion to family. He pursued the promise of a better future, not simply for himself, but for everyone he loved. He gave generously of himself, opened doors for others, and spent his life creating opportunity, security, and possibility for those around him." According to azfamily.com, Hector was a professor at Cal Poly Pomona and was scheduled to teach this spring. Larissa had been working as a psychiatric nurse practitioner. So on Tuesday, August 4th, 2026, relatives of the family asked Avondale police for a welfare check as they couldn't get in touch with Hector, Larissa, or Matthew. Public records indicate that this is their home. It is very nice. There's a Zillow listing. We'll link it on the blog.
The address is public knowledge, so we won't say it on here, but it is in a lot of articles. But basically, it's a beautiful, it says 6-bed, 4-bath house, 5,440 square feet. It's kind of a 2-story house. It looks beautiful. Like, it's got a big internal, you know, kind of grand staircase. Yeah. It's a lovely house. Very nice.
I don't know the word for like that style design. Yeah. Is it like, I don't know, is it Spanish? Is it Tuscan?
Well, I feel like it's, I don't think it's Tuscan. I would say more Spanish, probably.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm not really an expert, but I like, yeah, it's kind of,
It's got a look.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you guys look at it, let us know what the proper word is. The caller said they hadn't been able to get in touch with the family since July 29th, and he met officers outside the home and permitted them to go inside, but didn't want to go inside out of fear of what police might find in the home. Seems like like you'd think that they have an idea then of like something's going on.
Yeah.
Avondale police searched the home and didn't find anyone inside, but found a disturbing clue. Police officer Daniel Benavidez said officers discovered large amounts of blood and evidence of an attempt to clean it up, which indicated foul play. Police believed the three disappeared under suspicious circumstances and a missing persons investigation was opened. By Thursday, August 6th, a search was being undertaken at the home. Drone footage captured detectives digging with shovels and a mini excavator in the backyard. Officer Benavidez announced that two bodies were found in a state of decomposition in the yard. He said, "I can't tell you how many hours or days, but what I can say is the bodies are in a state of decomposition." So it seems like it wasn't just like a day ago that they were killed. Police said they were also processing vehicles for evidence, but didn't confirm how many vehicles were involved or how they may be connected to the case. A neighbor also told the media that the backyard pool next to where the bodies were found had just been added last month. So it's interesting. Authorities announced that they believed Matthew had fled the country and was considered a suspect in his parents' murders. The officer said, "I can't speak to why he fled the country. What I can say is that we believe him to be a suspect in this missing persons investigation." Now, homicide investigation, right?
Like, yeah.
Police spoke to neighbors about anything that they may have seen. Two neighbors independently reported seeing a suspicious vehicle circling the neighborhood around the time of the incident. She said, "I was so confused, and I'm honestly still so confused just seeing all this because our neighborhood is super quiet. We don't really have much going on here. I don't even really see my neighbors for the most part. I don't really see them come home. I don't see them leave. It's a super, super quiet neighborhood, so this is a shock to all of us. We're all just trying to figure out what the heck is going on and hopefully everything is good, and I hope everyone's okay." Well, they're not okay.
Yeah.
They're dead.
I feel like that may have come before they knew that the bodies
when
they were
missing.
Yeah.
The neighbor said she'd heard a person scream the words, "Please stop," the day before. She said she did not think much of it at the time. She said, "I was on the other side of the sidewalk and I definitely heard it come from that direction. But I was like, okay, we live by a middle school, so it might be nothing. So I didn't think more of it," which seems like it'd probably be unrelated if they were in a state of decomposition, but who knows? On August 7, 2026, the Avondale Police Department formally requested federal assistance to locate and apprehend Matthew. To coordinate international tracking efforts, the U.S. Marshals Service obtained a federal arrest warrant charging him with unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. At the state level, he faces charges of first-degree murder, dangerous domestic violence, and abandonment or concealment of a dead body. Relatives have spoken about how Matthew's behavior had changed over the years. Avondale police interviewed the family member who initially requested the welfare check, and he revealed that Matthew's behavior changed a great deal in college. He reported that Flores discovered his father had been cheating on his mother and was upset with his mother that she didn't leave him. The report says that once Matthew finished college, he moved back in with his parents and his lifestyle completely changed. The family member told authorities that he stopped drinking alcohol and began making vague, threatening comments such as, "You'll get what's coming to you." Family members reportedly noticed Matthew stopped socializing and was diagnosed with an unknown mental health condition. It was redacted in the police report. One relative recounted an incident where Larissa reportedly found him watering plants in the middle of the night because, quote, "the plants told me they were thirsty." A family member told police that they could not think of where Matthew would go, noting that he had no close friends or relatives in Mexico. Officers requested a ping of all three cell phones, but discovered that they were turned off and couldn't be located. Michael Klinkner is a mental health expert, and he believes that Matthew's mental health struggles may have been brewing for years. He said it's impossible to diagnose someone he's never met, but he can read between the lines. This is a quote from him. "We're talking about potentially positive auditory hallucinations, and in that case, it could be schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder. So no matter what the situation is, whether he's a psychopath, whether he's a sociopath, whether it's schizophrenia or any other diagnosis, this is a really scary situation and this is a really scary person. And so he has nothing to lose at this point and he knows it."
There's a retired FBI agent named John Iannarelli, and he said that the involvement of the FBI and the US Marshals expands the scope of this manhunt. He said the FBI has pretty far reaches and contacts with foreign law enforcement. They can leverage all of that to help us find this subject and bring them back to the US. He went on to say that Matthew cannot use any form of ID now, including his passport or his driver's license, because those documents are now flagged in law enforcement systems. He said he's not going to be able to use his passport because that passport's going to be in the system, as is his driver's license number. Any official contact he has with anyone with any sort of ID is going to tip them off, and that's what's going to get him arrested. This also makes obtaining legitimate employment almost impossible. The FBI agent said that being an American abroad could work against Matthew. He said he's going to stand out in a crowd because he's not going to look like the local population. Does he speak the language? All of that is going to be a hindrance. He may have fled law enforcement in the short term, but in the long term, he's going to get caught. He also went on to say that anyone who is willing to shelter Matthew faces their own set of risks. He said the problem with being overseas or perhaps in Mexico, you have to have people there willing to help you and are willing to risk getting in trouble with the law themselves. So the family have released a statement and they said the family is devastated by recent events. They are fully cooperating with law enforcement. Because this is an ongoing investigation, the family respectfully asks for privacy during this time. Their deepest gratitude is extended to their loved ones, neighbours and the community at large who have expressed concern. So Matthew, as of the time of recording, which is the 30th of August, is still missing. He's described as a white male, 6 feet tall, weighing approximately 177 pounds with blue eyes. So I know we mentioned Mexico. Police actually, or the FBI, haven't confirmed that it was Mexico where he went to. I feel like surely, though, that is the most likely. I had a look. You can get into Mexico from Litchfield Park at the Lukeville point of entry, which crosses into Sonora in Mexico. That's around 2.5 to 3 hour drive, 125 miles or 200 kilometers. So I feel like he had days and days to basically get ahead of everyone. If they were calling in the welfare check by the 29th of July and they didn't search the house until the 6th, and by that point, I guess they kind of figured out where he was. I'm guessing he used his proper passport or ID to enter whatever country he is in. So I would also suspect it's Mexico, but he basically had at least a week of a head start on authorities, it seems.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, like the one question I have is that is how did he manage to leave the country? That is how, because they didn't actually know to flag his passport or his ID until they found the bodies, which were, you know, let's say a week after they probably died. What was his motivation for allegedly doing this? Like, it seems like he did have some mental health concerns going on. I know the age of 27 or kind of mid 20s is the age where a lot of males will be diagnosed with schizophrenia and other conditions. So it does seem to me that this was just kind of an escalating mental health crisis that he was undergoing. And maybe that's just why he snapped and killed his parents. Maybe they were trying to set boundaries. I don't know. There could have been a bunch of reasons, but it does seem to me like this was probably mental health related in terms of Matthew's part.
Yeah, I agree. It is interesting that he killed both his parents because, well, I guess it does say that he was mad at his mom for not leaving the dad who cheated on her. So maybe he was mad at like both of them. I'm just curious, like, what is he doing in Mexico right now?
Or how is he surviving? Well, we're now at, he's probably been wherever he is for at least a month now. I guess you could take cash and that would get you pretty far. I don't really think the point the FBI agent made about him not being able to find legitimate work is a massive concern. I'm sure he could find some type of work down there, you know, off the, what do you call it, under the table. Yeah. I don't think that's a massive concern, but maybe he had enough cash to survive for months and months.
Maybe he's dead.
Yeah, he very well could be. Could have gone down there and taken his own life. Obviously, they have some type of evidence that he did either cross the border into Mexico or go somewhere, I guess Canada, but probably not Canada. I would say more likely Mexico. I doubt, doesn't sound like he's gotten on a plane. Sounds like more so he's in Mexico.
Yeah.
We did do an episode, like this is not the same. I'm just finding her name. We did do an episode last year about a woman who went missing, just kind of is slightly parallel. So she went missing in July last year and she has just been found in August 2026 alive in Mexico. So 13 months she was able to live down there kind of off, you know, under the radar without anyone knowing where she was for over 13 months. So it is possible. I guess it just depends on the means that he has in terms of being able to live and survive without raising any flags about using his ID.
I'm just curious about how it all went down. Like, why did he put the bodies in the backyard? I guess because he knew he was fleeing. It all just seems very, I guess.
But if you were going to flee, why would you bother
burying
digging up the backyard and burying the bodies, I guess?
And getting
maybe
a pool.
Bought him a little bit more time. I don't know. But for me, that just kind of indicates this weird plan. Like, he killed them.
Yeah, like, doesn't make sense.
Like, if you were really thinking somewhat rationally, be like, okay, well, they're dead. I've got to get out of here. I'll just leave them and go.
That's true.
I guess,
So maybe it sounds just like mental health crisis.
Yeah, I think that's what it is in this case, sadly. But we'll keep you updated if they do find him. The FBI are looking for him. I would be shocked if they don't eventually ended up finding him, but it has been a month and he's still somehow on the run. All right, so the second case we are going to discuss today is one out of Ohio. On a quiet August night in Delaware County in Ohio, Tamla Dutcher, who was 55, was inside her own home when a gunman allegedly walked in and shot her. The gunman also fired at her husband as he tried to help. But what turned the case into something far more complicated was the person investigators say may have been connected to the killing, and that's Tamla's 18-year-old daughter, Brianna. Within days of the murder, Brianna, her boyfriend Christian Evans, and his roommate DeJamius Payne were all facing murder charges, and investigators were examining alleged text messages and other evidence they say pointed to a plan.
The family of Tamla Dutcher sat in disbelief inside a Delaware County courtroom as they watched Brianna Dutcher stand accused of the murder of her mother, Tamla.
You understand that, ma'am?
Yes.
I had interviewed her mother, Tamla, 2 years ago on an unrelated story about annoying robocalls.
And that's how I feel. It's harassment.
Court documents reveal the crime inside their Bean Aller Road home may have been the result of a relationship Brianna had with Christian Evans, who was also charged with murder in the case. Brianna told detectives her parents didn't know about her boyfriend because they were, quote, very racist and would likely have kicked her out of the house. The family declined to talk after today's hearing. Prosecutors say after her arrest, they found text messages between Brianna and Evans talking about the crime.
There have now been text messages that have been recovered from her phone that appear to be planning the crime in advance. I would note for the court that the messages were deleted from her phone, but they were recovered by law enforcement during a forensic download.
Dutcher is also facing a charge of obstructing justice. Detectives say she lied about not knowing about who was behind the crime. 10TV also learned that Tamla Dutcher was not the only target. Court records say Christian Evans tried to kill Tamla Dutcher's husband as he gave medical aid to his spouse. All three defendants were given a $3 million bond. If convicted, they could each face a maximum of life in prison.
And court records also show that Christian Evans's father had a cell phone tracking device on his son's cell phone, which detectives say placed Evans at the Bean Aller address the night of the murder. Reporting live at Delaware County Courthouse, Kevin Landers, 10TV News.
So as some background into this case, Tamla Diane Dutcher was born on August 11th of 1971. She was known as Tammy, so we'll refer to her as that going forward. Her parents are Roy and Connie Dutcher, and she was their youngest child and their only daughter. So Tammy graduated from East High School when she was 16 in 1988. She then went on to Columbus State Community College on a full scholarship, and she would go on to transfer to the Ohio State University for her master's degree in social work. Tammy completed her PhD at the Union Institute in Cincinnati. On September 6th of 1997, Tammy married Neil King, and they have one daughter together who is Brianna. Tammy was said to enjoy serving her patients and their families, and she loved spending time with their family on their hobby farm. Interestingly, in 2002, Tammy co-authored an academic paper that focused on adolescent violence and homicide. The paper was called The Violent and Homicidal Adolescents, Hearts Darkened Before Time, which is a little bit eerie now that we know likely what happened. She basically wrote a paper on what would eventually likely be her cause of death. The paper discussed patterns amongst young people who commit killings and different approaches to understanding adolescent violence. So this all happened this month, August 2026. Brianna was 18 years old. On August 12th, police were called to an incident involving Brianna and her boyfriend, Christian Evans, who was 20. According to the affidavit, Brianna had been injured during what the two described as, quote, roughhousing, and she fell and she hit her throat against a wall. That was August 12th. On August 13th, it was reported that Tammy and Brianna had had a fight, and the fight was about cleaning. Brianna later told investigators that she called Christian afterward to vent about the argument, and Christian allegedly said, if I were you, I would have killed her. Shortly after midnight on Friday, August 14th, Neil called 911 to report that Tammy had been shot at their home. Responding officials found her there with gunshot wounds, and she was taken to a local hospital where she passed away. Brianna gave her first version of events of that night. She said that her boyfriend Christian and his roommate DeJamius, who was 21, had come to the family house. According to the affidavit, they wanted her to go somewhere with them, but Brianna advised that she wouldn't go with them because she had responsibilities with the horses. Brianna told law enforcement that she was then cleaning in a room when the door closed when the shooting occurred after midnight on August 14th. The shooting apparently happened around 10 to 15 minutes after her boyfriend and the roommate left the house. Brianna said that she didn't see anyone enter the home and that she heard a sound that, quote, caused her ears to ring. The affidavit says Brianna advised that the front door is usually locked but wasn't sure if it was tonight, and she advised that the rear door is also typically locked. Brianna told investigators that the garage door was open and the interior door leading from the garage was unlocked, but that she would have seen someone enter the house if they came in that way. Brianna also told investigators that they had about 100 firearms in the house and that she'd previously gone shooting with her parents, but she wasn't comfortable with the weapons. She gave investigators permission to collect a gunshot residue swab from her. The affidavit says Brianna could not think of anyone that was angry with her family that would lead to this act. She identified a former friend of her mother who owed a lot of money as the only potential person of interest. So pretty quickly, Brianna's story started to change. She initially said the door was closed, but she later said it was open. She remained adamant, though, that she would have seen anyone who walked past her, and she said again that she didn't know if the door was locked or unlocked. She also told authorities that she was in a relationship with a black man, which was Christian, and that her parents were not aware of that fact. Brianna said her parents were, quote, very racist and would have likely kicked her out of the house if she had have told them about the relationship. Weird and creepy aspect to the case, she said that DeJamius, who's the roommate, quote, had threatened to kidnap her family a few months prior and that she was scared of him. So law enforcement used flock cameras and observed Christian's Camaro in the area, traveling southbound at 12:44 a.m. The affidavit says, of note is that this is approximately 15 to 20 minutes after the shooting, and the mileage to travel from the incident location to this area is approximately 8 miles. Traffic cameras then caught the car going east on I-70 at Fairview Road in Guernsey County at 5:16 a.m., and the Camaro's last sighting was on Interstate 470 east at the Ohio and West Virginia border at 5:59 a.m. Brianna told investigators that Christian had a friend in Wheeling, West Virginia, and that she believed he may have been headed there. Investigators would later find the Camaro back at Christian's residence while they were getting ready to execute a search warrant. Law enforcement said they observed Christian leave the residence with a garbage bag in hand and throw the garbage bag in the dumpster. Detectives said that the men, as in Christian and the roommate, then left the apartment and got into the Camaro. The affidavit said detectives and deputies were able to block the vehicle in and take both parties into custody. After they were arrested, neither man agreed to speak with investigators. However, the document, the affidavit says Christian said that he was sorry for what he did. Authorities collected a gun holster and two pairs of black pants from the trash bag that Christian had thrown away. They also collected several electronics and a lease agreement that indicated Brianna was on the lease with Christian. An empty pregnancy test box and wet clothing were also recovered from the residence. Two cell phones and a gun holster were collected from the vehicle. And a neighbor of the men provided a video from an outdoor camera which showed them leaving their residence on the night of the shooting. Both were dressed in black clothing and each one was wearing one glove. So maybe they only had one pair of gloves one to share. Set. I don't know. The document states that Christian's father met with detectives and showed them a text from his son that said he, quote, fucked up. Christian's father also said he had Life 360 on his phone, and authorities were able to see that Christian was in the area of Brianna's house when the crime occurred. This is just so
that's crazy.
Sloppy. Turn your phone off. Like, at least try and do that. Like, imagine your life. Your Life 360 app is on while you're going to commit a murder. It's insane.
Yeah, Life 360 and murder just should not go hand in hand.
I feel like that's basically 101. Turn your phone off or leave your phone at home if you actually have a plan to do something like this. Even Brian Kroeger did that a little bit.
Yeah.
So investigators conducted a forensic download of Brianna's phone and recovered several deleted text messages. The affidavit doesn't provide timestamps of these messages, though, so we don't really know, but they are presented. We're going to read them out in the order they appear in the affidavit, which does appear to list them. Does not appear to list them chronologically. So these are, So Christian says to Brianna, they need to be hidden. He also says, once they both pass away, just in case, and I believe you should also get a gun too. Brianna wrote to Christian, all right, she's living room, he's basement. When you're here, let me know. Christian replied, we're getting ready. Brianna wrote, okay. Christian said, getting gloves, take them both out at the same time. Brianna replies, I got it. Christian says, this has to be perfect. Brianna says, I'll just take them down. Christian asks, how? And then she writes, yeah, we'll actually help. Like, some of this doesn't make sense, but I guess it just kind of gives you the bigger picture of what they were discussing. Christian goes on to say, shoes in the rain and all, you know about forensics and everything, right? How close are you to doing this? Brianna writes to him, river or burn. I'm guessing that means where you're going to dump stuff. And then Christian writes back, come outside and grab the Browning. So Christian and DeJamius were arrested and charged with murder on August 14th. Brianna was initially arrested on an obstruction of justice charge. On August 17th, prosecutors added a murder charge to Brianna's existing charge. And on August 20th, so just 10 days ago, a grand jury indicted all three for aggravated murder, replacing the earlier charges. The two men appeared in court on August 21st. Both pled not guilty to the aggravated murder charges, and Christian entered a plea not guilty by reason of insanity. Brianna pled not guilty to her charge on August 24th. The court has given her a $3 million bond. Her next major dates were set for a pre-trial hearing on October 19th, and her trial is scheduled to begin on November 3rd. Both men are due back in court in October. That seems like a very, very close trial date to when this all happened, like literally only two or three months. But that is apparently the trial dates that are currently set. I feel like this is a pretty obvious one, that they all three of them were involved. I guess the main reason is the motive for it. It does seem like Brianna's parents wouldn't have approved of her relationship with Christian.
Was she pregnant?
Yeah, well, maybe. I wonder if she was. Like, how did she get on the lease? I don't know. Maybe they had this plan for her to be able to move out, but maybe the parents wouldn't allow it. I don't know. So I just have questions about the motive. Obviously, that her father, Neil, survived. He will hopefully be able to give investigators a lot more information.
And it's just like the stupidity, like the Life 360, the texting about it. Like, there's so many mistakes. I get that they're very young, but it's like, come on, you guys are you idiots? Clearly, yes.
Even for him to say, you know about forensics and everything, right?
Like, yeah, you know about forensics, right?
Do you know about getting a burner phone? Do you know about turning your location off? Do you know about
you're literally putting this in writing?
Yeah.
Didn't you have two pairs of gloves?
Yeah, it's a dumb, immature crime that they were very, very sloppy about. And it did come to the charges were laid very quickly after it happened. So it was pretty clear, I feel like, from day one what happened. They just needed to gather this evidence, which was all there waiting for them.
Yeah, it's very sad, very cold of Brianna, like how they're just texting about it, like, oh, I'll take them down. Like,
yeah, and also for her to be like, she's living room, his basement, when you're here, let me know. Imagine just setting your parents
up. So casual.
Yeah. It's crazy.
So sad.
Sad for her dad too, because now he's lost his wife. His daughter will probably be in jail either forever or for a very long time. He's lost his whole family just because of this stupid, like, an 18-year-old
relationship that probably would have never lasted anyways.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like this is one, this one feels different to me than Matthew's one. I don't think this was a case of mental illness. It was a case of immaturity and a teenage girl probably not getting what she wanted or wanting something that she knew her parents wouldn't let her have. So rather than just deal with it, she tried to get rid of them in the most ridiculous way.
And it sounds stupid to say, but like looking at the pictures of all of them, it's like, girl, you murdered your parents for this guy.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I guess you can look at it both ways too. Like, he got involved.
Yeah, he murdered
for her.
Two people for this girl.
Like, ruined your life.
Yeah, you could say it both ways for sure.
Yeah. So very sad. I did watch a clip today, which is about Tammy's friends and family, about how much they loved her and what a great person she was. I do find it interesting that essentially her field of expertise is what she ended up passing away from. I wonder if Brianna had a history of behavioral issues or if this really was just, a teenage kind of kicking up a fit type situation where she wasn't getting what she wanted, or if there was more going on in the background, which we maybe, because obviously this is such a new case, as it goes to trial, we might hear a little
kinda
bit
like
more.
It's kind of like what we just recorded on Patreon too with Karen, like that being her job.
Mm.
Is that her name, Karen?
Yeah, we just recorded on Karen Solomon, who is a mental health advocate, and she ended up, she was a mental health advocate for police and police suicide, and she ended up killing her police officer husband and then taking her own life. So, yeah, very interesting that these women, not like, you know, Tammy had obviously studied this and ways that they can adjust adolescent behavior, and then she still wasn't able to do so with her own daughter. Very sad.
Yeah, it does make you wonder if that, I don't know, like the time periods, but if that's one of the reasons why she got into it, maybe there was some behavioral issues.
Well, I think, I don't even know if Brianna would have even been alive then, because that was 2002.
That's what I was saying, is it old?
2002, yeah. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think Brianna would have even been alive then.
That's so weird. Like, what are the chances?
Mm. Oh, that was written 6 years before Brianna was born.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Mm.
So niche.
So we'll keep you updated when they go to trial. They are due back in court fairly soon. I wouldn't be surprised if that is pushed out, though, based on, like, it just seems very speedy, but who knows, maybe it will go ahead. I'm interested, too, about Christian's insanity plea. Like, what is his history of mental illness, or is that just really one shot hoping for the best? Hopefully we'll hear a bit more about that.
I'm always interested about, like, the third person. Like, why are you getting involved in this? What's in it for you? Nothing.
Yeah.
What's his name? DeJamius?
DeJamius, yeah.
Like, how are you so easily convinced to just go murder two people?
Yeah. Like, what was in it for him?
Yeah. But yeah, so that's it for both of these cases. Everything will be on the blog, as always, at truecrimeside.com. If you want more content from us, check us out on Patreon. We do 2 episodes a week there. So there's a bonus episode and the main episode, all without ads. And the main episode comes out a day earlier as well. And we have some fun chats on there and all that. And we talk a little bit more on there with everyone. Check us out on Patreon. Make sure you're following us on Instagram too at True Crime Society. We're always posting new true crime stories and updates on there. My Instagram is StephSum_OliviasTCSOlivia if you want to see what we're up to. And make sure you're leaving us some comments on Spotify, letting us know what you guys think. Olivia loves to go through them. I go through them sometimes when I'm feeling brave. So, or if there's ones that are more for me, Olivia saves them and sends them to me so I can go check in. But yeah, we love getting Spotify comments. And if you could just share listening to the podcast, your Instagram stories, big help to us to spread the word of the podcast, you know, share what you're doing while you're listening. We love resharing them, seeing what everyone's up to. And that's it. So thank you guys for listening. Stay safe out there. Peace out.
See ya.